Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Discourse, the RSP's critical take on religion in the news. This is episode 9, I think. It's for July 2009. I'm David Robertson, as you are probably aware by now, and I'm joined tonight by Dan Gorman and Suzanne Newcomb. Dan, introduce yourself.
Hello, my name is Dan Gorman. I am an interloping American. I am a history PhD candidate at the University of Rochester, which is located on the southern shore of Lake Ontario.
And Suzanne?
Hello, I'm Suzanne Newcomb. I am a lecturer in religious studies at the Open University here in Britain. And I've also had a very long association with Inform, which was based at the London School of Economics, but has now moved to theology and religious studies at King's College, London.
And you're both colleagues of mine in different contexts, so this is nice and easy for me. I know everybody involved. Let's start then with Dan. You've got a couple of stories which are kind of bigger picture stories, good place to start. So kick us off with one, please.
So I have an article here from The Atlantic Monthly. Of course, it's not really monthly. It's posted online daily. It's by Peter Wehner. Now, Peter Wehner is he's an evangelical Christian writer. He's a conservative, but he's what we would call a never Trump conservative in this country. He is a fellow at a conservative think tank called the Ethics and Public Policy Center. And this article is called The Deepening Crisis in Evangelical Christianity. Now, Wehner's argument is that by associating themselves so strongly with Donald Trump, evangelical Christians in the United States are setting themselves up for disaster, the implication being that eventually something bad is going to happen to Trump's legacy or his momentum, and that evangelical Christians will then have to reconcile their behavior to date. So for example, Jerry Falwell Jr., who is the president of Liberty University, one of our largest Christian universities, tweeted some weeks ago, quote, "Conservatives and Christians need to stop electing nice guys. They might make great Christian leaders, but the United States needs street fighters like real Donald Trump at every level of government, because the liberal fascist Dems are playing for keeps and many Repub leaders are a bunch of wimps." Now, let's unpack that a little bit, sort of the way Wehner does. First of all, besides conflating liberalism and fascism, you notice there that Falwell's acknowledging that Donald Trump's conduct does not meet evangelical standards of behavior, and yet they're saying that's okay because he is defending their agenda, which means opposing gay rights, opposing abortion, these things that have become sort of mimetic knee-jerk responses for the religious right. So sort of the money quote from Wehner is that there's a very high cost to our politics for celebrating the Trump style, but what is most personally painful to me as a person of the Christian faith is the cost to Christian witness. And he's saying that by embracing someone who is more like one of the villains from the Old Testament as opposed to a prophet, evangelicals are, it's becoming a group mentality and that has nothing to do with Jesus's ethics. So we can take that from there.
So should the president be representing Jesus' ethics? Is that the ideal world?
Well, perhaps to Peter Wehner, the president would be. But see, that's his assumption, right? He's coming at it from the perspective of a conservative evangelical Christian. And even though he opposes Donald Trump, his separation of church and state may get a little blurry.
Indeed. That's a very interesting public position.
Yes, I mean, I certainly...
Is it particularly different from previous presidents? I mean, surely... he's very vocally kind of identifying with the religious right, and he's a strong supporter of Israel and things.
And he's not the first person to do that, as far as conservative presidents go. I think it's just... it's the rest of the conduct that is unpresidential. And the question is then, if you had a conservative president like George Bush, who is perhaps a little more restrained in his public persona, would that be more acceptable to someone like Wehner, a conservative? And the answer is probably yes, but I also don't want to put words in his mouth.
Yeah, it's also this normativity of Christian behavior. I mean, it's hardly unusual for conservative Christian public figures to later turn out to have not been the paragons of quote-unquote Christian virtue.
As far as religious discourse goes, what you take from this article is that Wehner's normative position, his home base is Christianity, right? So when if he were to speak about religion in America, he's probably going to be looking for things that reflect Christianity, so with a deity or key figure at the core of the religion. So it's sort of that Protestant, Catholic, Jew rhetoric that's been in our public media since the 1950s.
But then he's speaking to a specifically religious audience, and if we think about the media more generally, does the US media assume that they're speaking to a religious audience, do you think?
It seems to be that way. Now, again, I think some of the larger corporate media has done an attempt to explain Islam and other religions better. But again, it does seem to me that in America's, you know, mainstream corporate media, when they talk about religion, there is an assumption of some kind of a deity involved. You don't get these more academic ideas of religion that could be more about, for instance, a practice. Or, you know, I think there are certainly Buddhists who would not regard the Buddha as a God figure at all. But I think American journalists have trouble getting away from the God piece, even if the God isn't, you know, the Christian God.
There's an interesting, one of the stories I picked out makes a nice kind of contrast to this, and it comes from the other side. It's an opinion from the Washington Post, published on July 5th by Jennifer Rubin, and it's entitled "Justin Amash Explains Why the GOP is Irredeemable." Now, I'm not certain who Justin Amash is, and it's not of particular importance, but what struck me is the increasing use of language of cults around Trump and political rhetoric in general. I'm trying to find the exact quote here. So this is a quote from towards the end of the article. "There is no fighting a party in the grip of a mentally, morally, and emotional unfit figure such as Trump. You cannot break up a cult from the inside. You must leave it and then draw others away, compelling them to reflect and shed their delusional beliefs." Now, there's a clearly normative position there on cults equals bad, okay? So cults are delusional, and they're something that you must break up.
Arguably, that's what cult means.
But I can hear the ghost of hear the ghost of Christopher Hitchens, though, saying that all religions are, you know, involved, you know, irrationality and following people blindly.
Right, this is what my friend says. I was talking to him recently, and I said, you know, you shouldn't use cults because you're sort of stigmatizing some religions as being irrational. And he said, yeah, but I think all religions are cults. And I said, yeah, but you're only referring to some of them as cults. So when you do that, you legitimize other ones. But yeah, it's interesting that there's been a real return to the language of cults in the media in the last few years, and a large part of it has been around politics, specifically Trump. And I wonder why that language has returned so vociferously.
Well, in Britain, I mean, I'm more familiar with American media, but in the British media, are you hearing equivalent references to cults these days?
Well, there was quite a lot of vicarious, nosy interest in the Nixium, which then revised the kind of Children of God stories. And I think that anything that's a bit involves sex and violence is always a bit juicy.
But yeah, you're right. I mean, that stuff's popular, but it is largely coming out of American media.
I'm just thinking, like, it's not really a cult of Boris Johnson, but there are some anxieties about him. People like having photographs of him that are a bit iconic, like Conservative Party supporters. I've read that somewhere.
You see, to me, as the American looking at this, to me, Brexit and Trump, it doesn't seem like a cult thing because, again, cult's a loaded term, but typically these new religious movements are small, whereas we're talking about millions of people supporting Brexit or Make America Great Again. I mean, to me, this seems the case of a more mainstream religion with a certain degree of fundamentalism.
Right, yeah, but the word cult is being used to paint it as irrational and, you know, mentally, morally, and emotionally unfit. It's a clear
recognition.
That if you agree with this person, then you're irrational or brainwashed or, you know, in some other way, you can't be a rational human being and accept this is true. That, which is why they don't, if they were to refer to it as a religion, then, you know, this would be to paint.
But then going back to the comment
positive.
That you originally started the cult conversation with, there was this assumption that you've got to leave the cult in order to transform it. Which, I mean, if you look at the vast history of lots of new religions, they have all sorts of reform trajectories. Not all of them involve former members coming and kind of tearing it down from the outside. I mean, if you've got Jesus as the first, perhaps in American history, but quite often a lot of change happens through other social pressures. It's not necessarily former members defecting.
Right, but as you said, you know, the sensational narratives tend to focus on, crimes or accounts by apostates as well, you know, especially in the case of Scientology and things like that. I did think, though, that the Wild Wild Country was a surprisingly even-handed.
Yeah, I did say that.
I don't know if you saw it.
It's funny. It's funny you mention that because I'm actually teaching a cult. Let's try that again. Teaching a course about cults and new religious movements this summer, and we're supposed to watch Wild Wild Country next week. So I will be watching it very soon.
What did you make of it?
It did a very good job of showing how and why people might be drawn in and how it got so crazy. I thought the footage of Sheila, who was the kind of often blamed as the architect behind the Rajneesh's downfall, and she was certainly the kind of fall person, and the filmmakers tracked her down in Switzerland. And she still gives this kind of very charismatic, but almost slightly... something slightly off about her as well. And it's just really fascinating to see it kind of very, very much in your face. You can kind of see how people could join.
Oh yeah. She's fascinating. Yeah, terrifying, but yeah.
I guess what I'm getting at is for me, I just don't find cult useful. It's a meme. It's a thing that's repeated and people don't think about its meaning, or they don't give it meaning. It just shuts down conversation. And, you know, this is why we've got that ungainly term, new religious movement, which means the same thing as cult, but trying to be nicer about it.
Yeah, well, that's true. I for me, it's tied into polarizing narratives of othering, of sort of us and them language. People like us do things like this. And it flares up at times when it seems that things are very polar and very hopeless. So we saw a lot of it in the 80s, and it kind of went away a bit towards the middle of the 90s and through the 2000s. And now it's come back when we're back in this kind of Manichaean political situation again, which, you know, we were in the 80s with the Cold War and it certainly seemed like politics was polarized back then as well. I think that there's a relationship between, portraying other groups as irrational, and this kind of
Absolutely, and this, the polarization, and it's associated with the word cult, is also kind of some of the naive curiosity that I think drives a lot of us in religious studies of how could they believe that. But I think with politics so polarized, it's so hard to step into that other person's shoes that it kind of must be a cult.
And then there's the problem also, like I was trying to get up before, that one person's cult is someone else's religion. And if we're always saying that only the bad things happen in cults, we turn a blind eye to the things that happen in mainstream religions.
Absolutely.
Anybody?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There was a conversation recently amongst some scholars of new religions about what they should call them. And I just kept saying, why don't we just call them religions?
Well, I think then there's the piece of how do we define countercultural or subculture and who's against whom?
Yeah.
If we have to be honest.
I suppose you do it by power and demographic issues of who has control and who forms the majority. Yeah, I don't know. And Eileen Barker has moved much more towards the kind of sociological demographic, specifically defining new religious movements. So it's a movement with first generation membership and a charismatic leader that then has other demographic and kind of predictive qualities, with people being more willing to do things they wouldn't have thought of before than in a movement where there's several generations of parents and children who have learned that their children aren't perfect and they can't control the world.
Yeah. And we just have to keep that going for 2,000 years and we'll have a model of Christianity.
Hooray!
Suzanne, you've got some it's kind of more positive examples of religion and religious scholarship.
Yeah, so some of this is coming. I wanted to kind of highlight some things that have come across my radar recently that I think are really interesting and might be of interest to other scholars. And I guess I'll start with the Religion Media Centre, which is kind of a new charity in Britain, which is modelling itself off the Science Media Centre, but it's aiming to help connect journalists who are often running on this 24-hour news cycle and don't have time to do proper research, to connect them with higher quality information about religion and to offer proactive comment and kind of be a broker in terms of raising the standard of religious reporting in the media. It's UK based, but I'm sure they'd be very happy to have lots of Americans on their network. So I'm going to have David put the link up. So you can write fact sheets or kind of tell them about your area of expertise. If you know something in the media, you can offer a comment and they'll help get it out there, which might be good for other stats and those kind of impact things that academics are supposed to be interested in these days. So I went to a kind of festival there recently, and what I found most interesting was this young journalist, Sophia Smith Galler, who is doing short videos for the BBC World Service to go on their Instagram and Twitter feeds. And her brief is really to do religious programming for under 25s and to try to capture them, which of course aren't reading the broadsheets. They're not interested in what the American conservative Christians have to say. And she's produced this really interesting series of short videos, which again, there'll be a link to. But I wonder, like, if we're talking about religious in the media, what media are we talking about, and how that demographic is going to shift quite soon, and where are the young people getting their information from, and where are their messages coming from?
That's
so
true.
I was quite interested in this proactive. She's done just so many different, but a lot of her videos are on this edge of what is religion and what is not religion, and what does faith and belief and belonging mean for young people today? Which, this is going to turn into a monologue, which is also what there's a set of new resources from RE Online, which is providing resources for religious education teachers in Britain, which is still a mandatory subject for, I think, up until GCSE to some part. Some schools take it more seriously than others. But there's a real kind of movement towards looking more at worldviews, looking at kind of faith and ethics and humanism, which kind of leads on to another story in the media about the latest British social attitude survey showing that the British population's reached the tipping point of people not more people don't identify with any religious tradition than identify with Christianity now.
Yeah.
Sorry, I talked too long.
Okay, there's quite a lot there. Immediately. No. It's fine. It was very. You got a lot of information in, actually. In a couple of minutes.
Media training. I'm trying to get
just
more
that last
in 2 minutes.
Point. Yeah. It's the Instagram format. I could see that you're bang up to date with your media work.
It's not quite so
fantastic. we're going to come back to the secularism thing. I know that Dan wanted to talk about that. Was it the UK figures or the US figures you were wanting to talk about, Dan?
Well, actually, one of my articles is about the same survey you were talking about, yeah. Suzanne, the British social attitudes for 2018. So what struck me in The Guardian when they were talking about the survey, and they mentioned that, again, only one in three people are Church of England. Britain is becoming more secular. Lots of people are atheist or no religion. This may just be a summary of the article as opposed to the actual survey. But my concern is that this survey is confusing not being in a religion with not believing in a higher power of some kind or engaging in practices.
Yeah, and so there's one of the other big topics at this Religion Media Centre conference, which was most of the media representatives there, to be honest, were from the BBC, who have a quite high standard of religious reporting compared to a lot of other media outlets. But there was this kind of emphasis on the non-religion and secularity network, and that there's been a lot of Templeton grants in Britain going out in the last maybe 5 years looking at non-religion and also talking to some of the people who have been managing those grants about how they didn't choose the term non-religion and that was chosen for them because in fact what they're trying to emphasize and what the kind of school project to talk about worldviews is trying to emphasize is that it doesn't necessarily mean these people don't believe anything or don't practice anything. It's just that they don't want to identify with an organized religion for a whole host of reasons. So it's a very messy area.
Well, and this is the long history.
Absolutely.
And this is the history in the United States of people seeking spirituality, which means believing in things without all the rules of religion.
I think that most of the evidence at the moment is that people aren't really going for that spirituality new age category, which was being kind of investigated maybe 10 years ago or 15 years ago as something that might be happening, but that people and young people do care very deeply about matters of ethics and belief in the world and that especially climate activism with the kind of Extinction Rebellion and lots of school children in Britain had gone on strike in the final months of the term. I'm sure that they want an excuse to go on strike, but they do feel very passionately about the environment and that this kind of activism and seeing the world as a meaningful and important thing to protect has an element of faith in it or belief.
Well, the largest thing that's different is the people who, in the absence of anything else, will say, you know, if the default is to say, used to be to say, yeah, I'm Church of England or whatever, Catholic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now the default is, I just don't have a religion.
And
that's the thing. The only thing that's different is that they're not. No, the behavior's not that different. I mean, maybe there's a long-term decline in people who go to church because that's what you do. That's been declining since the 1950s. But the thing that's changed dramatically recently is people just not saying, yeah, I'm a such and such by default. And it, you know, unless they actually kind of mean it. The figures are actually slightly higher in Scotland, which is interesting. We tipped over to it being a majority of people who said no religion,
really,
not not that was no, 2011. At the last census, which when was that?
I mean, according to this, I'm just looking at the
2011.
British Social Attitudes 1983 to 2018 data, and it looks like actually the tipping point was like 2009, when more people were saying no religion.
Thanks, Obama.
But I mean, something happened so it just became more socially acceptable. And being culturally Christian didn't mean so much.
Yeah.
But I mean, the legacy.
You can see a general decline in faith in all sorts of institutions. I meant faith in the secular sense there, of trust in institutions and as authoritative. You know, across politics, across science in the last 10 years or so, and trusting in the good old C of E.
Absolutely. So some parallels to the 1960s in that, but I don't know that we're going to get a summer of love out of it. summer of mad rain. Climate and anxiety.
Rage.
Yeah, but it's quite interesting looking like trolling for news items. I mean, there is certainly an idea of being culturally C of E is still important because there's lots of speculation about Meghan Markle and Archie's christening and that this all should be done in the normal kind of Daily Mail over 65s. This should all be done according to tradition.
Oh yeah, it's not because it's according to tradition. It's because he will be, you know, whoever is the monarch is the head of the Church of England. That's why the concern about that.
Yeah, I don't think most of the Daily Mail readers with that up on their constitutional. It might be in the back of their heads. I think it's still cultural.
Oh, no, I don't think Daily Mail readers are very up on very many things, but the very smart people who are determined to defend the status quo and the power of the wealthy by writing in a manner which they pretend to be stupid in order to fleece working class right wing people. They want to. They know what the constitution is. Yeah, that's quite cynical, I suppose. Daniel, you had a story for us as well about the religion of millennials, if you like.
Yes, and this was interesting because this is a case of so the author's name is Jessica Roy, and she's writing for the Los Angeles Times. How millennials replaced religion with astrology and crystals. What stands out about the article, and first of all, Roy's a good writer, and she's trying to understand the forms of religious life that don't look like religion as defined by legacy media and Daily Mail readers. And so the things she describes are breathwork, the use of crystals as sort of meditative or power objects, which is sort of totemic. The line that really stands out from the article is that Roy writes, "No, they don't particularly care if you think it's woo-woo or weird. Most millennials claim not to take any of it too seriously themselves. They dabble, they find what they like, they take what works for them and leave the rest." Now, to me, that does sound like New Age. So I'm wondering, is the spiritual but not religious movement a part of the New Age? Are they separate? Do they overlap?
Well, as a self-identifier, it fell out of favor probably by... You know, certainly by 1990, nobody was referring to themselves as New Age anymore. But there, you know, this is kind of Steve Sutcliffe's argument that there's clearly identifiable patterns of behavior. And this idea, seekership, for instance, there you said, talking about people trying different things out to see what works with a sort of playful attitude. That's a classic example of the kind of seekership that Sutcliffe and Buterhanagraph and also Colin Campbell's seminal article on the cultic milieu identify as these kind of central tropes of what used to be called the New Age milieu. And I still refer to it as that, even though nobody in it refers to.
But I think it'd probably, if you did a Venn diagram, there'd be an overlapping bit of the New Age, of the kind of yoga classes and astrology or whatever. But then you've also got a really interesting flowering of kind of these pop cultural religious references, and like I said, the kind of eco identification. And so I think that the way young people are drawing on metaphors and images to find inspiration and kind of pathways for creating meaning in life is broader than the New Age remit, but you could still identify the kind of seekership patterns.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. And there's also interesting crossovers with kind of the kind of productivity business kind of stuff as well, you know, where affirmations and things like this. It's like The Secret. Remember that book from 10 years ago, 15 years ago? And that kind of stuff, that kind of, if you think positively, you can manifest things in the universe. That stuff pops up all the time in kind of, you know, business and these kind of life hacking stuff.
More than that, it's Marianne Williamson is running for president on that platform.
Okay. So she'll have to try a lot of visualization.
Yeah, I guess Oprah Winfrey's kind of rumored a candidacy was also kind of based on the same lines. But then, of course, this has its basis in New Thought, which has been around for over 100 years.
Oh yeah.
But I think a lot of people are very cynical about it as well. They don't.
Yeah.
They can't take it seriously. But if it kind of calms them down a bit and gets them through the day, that's kind of all right.
And that's how William James defined a religion right there.
Yes, that's a good point. But is it cynical or is it playful? That's, I think the traditionally religious will often describe it as being, oh, it's cynical.
I think the cynicism comes from this institutional distrust
rather than
a kind of disrespect of the idea. But because the power structures, that the people in authority have been so damaged by scandal after scandal, you've got to be a bit skeptical.
Yeah, yeah. So cynical in the original Greek sense, rather than the more modern.
But you know what's interesting, listening to this conversation and thinking about how, as Suzanne just mentioned, how New Thought has been around for 130 years at this point. In some ways, these practices we ascribe to the New Age or the SBNR moments, they've been happening it's not new anymore, right? These things have been around. So the question is then, is the shift in recent years that it's no longer people who are nominally members of mainstream religions also practicing these new things? Now are we seeing a moment where the old are falling away and now it's just the new things? Is that the change?
I think it's the former. The example I like to think of is
the Australian
Kinsey
one.
Report that had that on sexual behavior. Have I got the right name for the report?
The
American one.
There were a couple. He wrote two, one on men and one on women.
But it was Kinsey. I've got the name right.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So that changed dramatically our knowledge of what people were doing, but it didn't cause them to do anything different. They were already all doing it, but they now didn't have to identify as only, you know, straight or gay. Well, monogamous or whatever. But it revealed to a wider spectrum that was going on underneath the surface. But as long as you've got a hegemony that says, oh, you ought to be a member of this religion, people like us are a member of this religion, and those who aren't are outsiders, then people will gather under that umbrella. When that hegemony breaks, you don't have to anymore. But people, I think, are still doing the same things they always were. I remember somebody telling me that about Catholic countries, for instance. Poland has something like 90% identification as Catholic, but it's riddled with folk beliefs and kind of magical things and little local practices and all sorts of, you know, all of the shrine and sort of goddess worship that goes on in popular Catholicism. So it's although it seems like it's strongly Catholic.
Absolutely. And I think the challenge for us as scholars, which I don't have an answer to, is how do we keep convincing people of the importance of studying religion as a category, even where we're trying to undermine the traditional markers of what religion is?
So this is the they say, I say thing, right? So,
well, go ahead, Dan. Yeah.
So what I meant by that was it's the challenge as scholars of religion is for us, we have our own analytical categories, but also understanding the discourse, the way the word religion is used. And one reason to study it is that, especially on the conservative end, people who believe very strongly in religion,
yes,
we see that now fueling these identitarian Absolutely. Movements around the world.
But if we also want to argue that religion is an integral part of being human without necessarily identifying with a world religion or an established institution. And it's still important to study for that reason. I think the argument in public discourse becomes much more difficult to articulate.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think... saying to people, you know, I've had people say to me, you know, like the critical kind of theory stuff that I do, it's just arguing over definitions. I don't see it that way. I see it as being able to understand which of the many different ways of thinking about religion that people are using at any given time. So, you know, as you said, you know, the evangelicals that we talked about, for them, a very theistic and church-based kind of model of religion is what they're talking about, connected to morals. But it might not be what the millennials who are, you know, doing yoga or crystals or whatever. But they're all things which are important to people in different ways, and being able to untangle that and articulate this a category that is important to people, whether whatever version is important.
I absolutely agree. I think it does become harder when people don't want to identify with the word anymore. Although they're still...
yes.
We should put out a press release insisting that they go back to using the word, because after all, we've got a department in it, so it must... Well, it must exist.
And then the challenge for us is then saying all these other things, you may not call it religion, but it is religion. And this is, you know, let's point to all the football clubs that are really religions.
Oh, I can hear Russell McCutcheon spinning in his seat already. I think we as scholars want to identify lots of things as religion is part of the problem.
But I mean, as you pointed out, Dan,
well,
the rise of religiously laced populism globally doesn't appear to be going away anytime soon. So that provides us a point of discussion, at least.
No. And how will that change the narrative of growing secularization in, say, 20 years?
Yeah, absolutely. That's an interesting point. We'll see. We'll see. Maybe these more traditionalist and Christian groups would have had an easier time of it in previous generations, just by appealing to religious narratives that don't work as well anymore. We'll see. I think we've come to a pretty good place to end. I think we've been through all of our stories and ended up with a discussion about the field that's more broad. So let's wrap up there. So I'll say thank you, Dan. Thank you, Suzanne. Have you anything that you want to?
I think I've gotten all my plugs in.
Anything to advertise or anything like that before we go? Excellent.
Yes, I don't have anything. I don't have anything to plug right now, but I'm just remembering the immortal words of the whole Earth catalog: "Stay hungry, stay foolish."
Indeed, I often am accused of both of those things. You'll be hearing more from Dan through the year on the RSP. Hopefully, you'll be hearing from Suzanne soon as well, and you'll certainly be hearing from me. But until next time, thanks for listening.
The RSP is sponsored by the British Association for the Study of Religions, the North American Association for the Study of Religion, and the International Association for the History of Religions. The Religious Studies Project is produced by the Religious Studies Project Association, SCIO, a Scottish charitable incorporated organisation, charity number SC047750.
Brought to you by founders and editors-in-chief Chris Cotter and David Robertson, and managing editor Thomas J. Coleman III. Our features are edited by Marek Sullivan and Rebecca Barrett-Fox, and our opportunities digest by Ella Bock. Podcast transcription by Helen Bradstock, with audio editing by Gregory Schneider and Samuel Ward. Social media managed by Ray Radford, sales and marketing by Sammy Bishop, and video editing by Jonathan Tuckett.
Don't forget, you can support the project by using our amazon.com, .co.uk and .ca links, or donating at patreon.com/projectrs, and you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, YouTube, iTunes and other portals.